Hey, everyone, and welcome to episode 17 of Vancouver Overcast with Mike Klassen. On this episode of the podcast, we're going to discuss part two of 2021's biggest stories in local government in British Columbia, as decided by me and my guest, Daniel Fontaine. Before we get underway discussing the rest of the stories of the year, I want to thank everyone who subscribed, liked, shared, or emailed me comments on the podcast. If you're new to the show, I invite you to visit www.overcastyvr.ca to learn more on subscribing, sharing, and supporting Vancouver Overcast with Mike Klassen. Now we'll pick up the conversation with Daniel on 2021's top BC local government stories and why they matter. So I'm going to move into August now, and a topic that I think touches upon many communities, not just some of the major centers. And it's about the opioid crisis. And what can you say about a topic that just continues to dole out really terrible news year after year after year? We had an unbelievable number of people, 7,700 lives have been lost in British Columbia alone to poisoned opioid drugs and fentanyl. I know that when you were working at the City of Vancouver with the mayor, and Sam Sullivan, to his credit, had some very progressive, I think probably almost ahead of his time, thinking about how to address the drug crisis. What do local governments need to do in BC to get their handle on this tragedy?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. And I think that the opioid crisis is one of three crises we're facing right now. One is the climate crisis. The other is the COVID crisis, the pandemic. And the third one is the opioid crisis. And sadly, Mike, the opioid crisis is not winning in terms of getting the public's attention or getting the attention of our elected officials. And yet, sadly, it's the one that's killing the most people right now. I mean, those numbers are absolutely staggering, and they're getting worse. They're not getting any better. Mayor Sullivan, when I did work for him, yes, he was a progressive mayor. He was, in fact, he was fighting a lot of the people who claimed to be progressive. They were fighting him for some of the initiatives that he was putting forward in terms of decriminalization and ensuring that we kind of change the narrative around people who are using drugs and who they are within our community, and whether they should be seen as criminals or not, and whether or not this is a health issue or a criminal issue. And Sam was pushing that and really pushing the envelope a lot on that. And what's good to see is that he was a mayor. He was the mayor of a city. He had a voice, and he could speak out, and he could actually raise these issues. And you know, it was good to see that leadership coming there. And there are other mayors that have, you know, come since him, and other local elected officials who've spoken out. But I think that's a role for municipal officials. When they're seeing so many people dying on their streets, they should be encouraging the federal and provincial governments to be, again, putting more into mental health supports, looking at being able to ensure that these people are not thrown and incarcerated for simple things like simple possession of drugs, that kind of thing. I know it's controversial, and I know that I'll probably get a lot of hate mail and stuff after your podcast for this, but I just firmly believe that, you know, you have to treat this primarily as a health issue and not a criminal issue. But you also have to understand, you know, like, our police are facing something on the streets right now that I would not want to be a police officer and not know what to do, like, and just not have the tools to be able to actually deal with someone who's on the street. So it's a very challenging thing. But I am very pleased to see that there, since, you know, 08, 09, when these things are being pushed, and I should say also Mayor Philip Owen really started the whole thing with the four pillars approach and kind of trying to expand that discussion around this. It's good to see that so many of those initiatives that were pushed and that were being advocated for back then are now being adopted by the federal government, and are we still have a long way to go, but there's been some really good movement. But too many people are dying. We're obviously not hitting all the right marks on all this, and more needs to be done.
So we're going to talk about Philip Owen momentarily, but I want to talk about another issue that is, it's a recurring theme, but it has some interesting implications for how cities are governed. lot of people have heard about the Sohota family, who infamously have been seen, has been described as slumlords by some political figures. They have buildings in Vancouver that become dilapidated and almost uninhabitable. Sadly, back in the news this week in the cold snap in Vancouver, because one of their buildings has the furnace failing and people having to huddle around electric heaters to try and stay warm. But we know that this has been a political football for years, going way back to the 2000s, when there were cries and attacks by a political figure saying we should take these buildings away from these owners. Ultimately, in September, City Council did finally approve that. But that was years and years and years that went by on that one. I know that when you were working in the mayor's office with Sam Sullivan, that this issue was out front there and as well. Why is it taking local governments so long to react to these kind of situations? And do they have an obligation? Do governments have an obligation to take away buildings that are effectively harming people?
Well, again, lots to unpack in there, so I'll try to respond. But I will say it is a complex issue. So anyone who tells you that it's a simple issue that the city can come in and just do whatever it wants, they've never either been in government, they haven't spoken to the legal counsel of the folks who are advising the elected officials at City Hall. It is very, very complex. But what I will say is what I do find rather ironic and of, I guess, some political interest is that, you know, when the NPA was in power, when Mayor Sullivan was there, there was a lot of attacks and political attacks from his opponents, primarily in the Vision Vancouver side and the COPE side at the time, who were saying, you know, do more. You just have to just go in there and clean things up and get this fixed and get rid of the Sohotas, etc. But I look at a decade of Vision Vancouver government, and who are you and I still talking about today? The Sohota family, who are back in the news again. So even after a decade, three elections, where they won, Vision Vancouver was unable to tackle this issue with a vast majority. So it is complex, Mike. And part of the problem is that, you know, the city should be going down, and where there are violations and where people are not adhering to basic things like heating and lighting, et cetera, the city has a full role and should be going in there and inspecting the buildings to make sure that they meet minimum standards. Absolutely, 100%. The flip side to that is they can go and shut down all these buildings, but I ask you the question, and this is the question that all elected officials, whether they be COPE or Vision or One City or whomever, where do these people go? Do you shut these buildings down and put them out on the street? And is that the solution? And I think that's, you know, where I think former housing minister Rich Coleman was going with all of this in terms of buying some of those SROs and buying the land and reinvesting, is we need to build that capacity first to be able to move these individuals into these more appropriate housing venues. But in the absence of that, all you're going to do by shutting down that building is effectively moving all these people out onto the street. Now, do I think it's as simple as just saying you can't do anything? No, there are things you can do. There have been some cases where the city's gone in, it has fined, it has gone in and done some of the work itself and, you know, charged the landowner. And I think the city should be creative where they can be and go in there and do that stuff. But I think they should be really careful about going in. And I've seen it happen to, like I said, many, many governments where they talk a good talk, but when they get in there, they realize that if they really go hard, they're going to have literally thousands of people out on the street, and they're going to make the problem even worse. And so it is complex, Mike. I wish I could tell you there was a silver bullet, but I didn't see it when I was there, and I know Vision didn't see it when they were there for 10 years. But I think there are some solutions that have been tried, and we have to continue that. But ultimately, it's about building better housing, building more housing, and making sure that when people are requiring that housing, that it's there when they need it.
So we're going to now get up to October here. There's one big story, but I also wanted to mention somebody we just mentioned, Mayor Philip Owen, who passed away at 88 years old. And there was a really interesting outpouring for Mayor Owen and his legacy. Maybe you could talk a little bit about why you think people were so emotional in a way. People from all political stripes were singing the man's praises after he was gone. And what he kind of represents to, and I think you said to me at one time that he really represents the politics the way it used to be in local government here. But what are your sort of thoughts about Mayor Owen's passing?
Well, it saddened me. I knew Philip very well, and he had contributed so much to this city that well beyond what has even been written or even people know about. I mean, he was the hands-on mayor. He was the mayor that would go down on the street, would talk to the homeless people. He would be out there on the street talking to the city workers. He was not someone who sat on the upper floors of City Hall and just kind of ran things from there. So he also, while he represented the establishment in many ways, people saw him as kind of the West Side, well-connected kind of from the city of Vancouver. He also broke the mold in many ways. He was non-establishment. I mean, he was doing things that only Philip could do around talking about the issues of drug use and in terms of the things that were happening on the downtown east side. And I think that's what surprised, and I think that'll be his legacy. People will remember that for those viewers who really want to go back in the time vault, I mean, he led a city council where he controlled every single seat on council and every single seat on the park board and the school board. People liked him that much. He was, a very strong, stable leader. And he had built a bit of a dynasty there in terms of his bringing folks into the coalition. And what I liked about Philip and what I really respected with him is that he could work with people on all different sides of the political spectrum. He had within his camp people who, like Nancy Shaverio and Gordon Price, who would identify as being more left of center and more kind of social Democrats. And then he had people who were in his camp, like George Pule and Jennifer Clark, could be deemed to be more on the right of center politics, and a lot of people in between and in the middle. And we've lost that. And when Philip passed away, it was kind of a little bit of an end of that era. And you talked about it earlier about what's happening at Vancouver right now. I'm sure Philip is looking at this going, wow. he just must be shaking his head going, what is going on? Because I know that Philip first and foremost put Vancouver first. He told everyone to put their provincial and federal politics aside, told them, if you're coming to City Hall or you're coming to school board, you're coming to the park board, you're putting all that partisan stuff aside and you're putting the city first. And boy, I sure miss that. I think we need a lot more of that, even in 2022.
Again, he was a nonpartisan association mayor, one of the greats. So we're going to talk about regional governments for a second. Metro Vancouver, which is a huge governing body that operates a number of jurisdictions around Metro Vancouver. It got into trouble again. And again, it was a little bit of deja vu. We remember when we were doing city caucus, there was the there was a water pipeline that was going between two major watersheds that were supplying the city's water, and it got into a big problem. It ended up costing, well, hundreds of millions. It went over budget. We've just seen another wastewater project go slightly sideways, potentially, costing us a lot of money that will ultimately all be paid by property taxpayers. Why are we having these kinds of major problems? I know it's, again, it's a complex issue, but is there a way that we can avoid these kinds of things in the future?
Well, I don't know, Mike, that's a tough question. How do you avoid boondoggles and how do you avoid waste? I mean, those are very large issues. I don't think we're ever going to get rid of it. But I tell you, the scale of which what we're seeing in Metro Vancouver is just, it truly is mind-boggling. We're talking, literally hundreds of millions of dollars that are just evaporating and going out, being, excuse the pun, being flushed down the toilet. Let me say, first of all, that Metro Vancouver serves a very important role, and the people that work at Metro Vancouver do a great job. I mean, when you flush your toilet, you turn on your water, you have your utilities. I mean, that's what they do, and they do it well, and they do it on a regional basis, and it makes a lot more sense to do that regionally than it does to have 23 separate municipalities. So I want to get that on the record first. But I will say that where I do have concerns, and you and I have talked about this for the better part of over a decade, is the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability, the lack of understanding, I think, by voters as to who is at Metro. And this whole finger pointing, you know, when something happens at Metro Vancouver, they point the finger at municipal, well, you know, there's all these municipal people elected to the board. And then you go to the municipal folks and they point over to Metro and say, well, look, it's out of my control. I only have a few votes. I can't control it. It's this large beast that has really, in my view, just gotten so big, it has lost touch with the average person. I'm looking at the increases in the percentage increases in costs for things like sewer, water, the utilities. It's just, the term mind-boggling comes to mind. It's just, we're talking not only a little bit above the rate of inflation, we're talking it's blowing past it sometimes five times the rate of inflation. And yet people's paychecks are not going up that much. People have lost their jobs, in particular during the pandemic, there's been a huge disruption. So when I see stories like this, Mike, yes, there was the tunnel twinning project. There's now the water filtration plant. There will be another one. And they'll continue to happen as long as there's no media coverage of Metro Vancouver or limited coverage of Metro Vancouver. And there's no political accountability for the people who are at the board.
I actually, when I was doing a bit of research on another topic, I encountered some old news clippings. We used to have some directors that were elected by Vancouver voters and Surrey voters. We had people that, so there was that kind of direct political accountability. We no longer have that because they are simply appointed usually by the mayor's office in each of the municipalities.
Patronage appointments by the mayor's office.
And again, with the greatest respect, if you threw me into trying to make the judgment call on a multi-billion dollar project, I would say, you know what, I probably need a lot more either background or experience or understanding of this before I can make an intelligent vote. I'm just worried that the governance model needs to be really reconsidered in some ways.
Yeah, and I know there's a whole other discussion for another podcast around whether or not we need kind of elected Metro Vancouver reps. I'm not sure just simply electing Metro Vancouver reps is going to result in no boondoggles and no cost overruns. So I don't think it's that simple. I think it goes to a bigger picture of openness and transparency and accountability overall. And maybe perhaps, Mike, that could be a solution of getting people directly elected. I don't know. Whether or not those people who are elected at large in the Metro Vancouver region would be any different than the ones who are appointed and through patronage to that board, I don't know, the jury's out, but I do think it begs a bigger question around our governance structure. We've grown a lot in the last 20, 30 years. Our region doesn't even look like it did 30, 40 years ago when this construct of this Metro Vancouver was built. I think the time has probably come for us to have a debate on whether or not the next 30, 40 years should look the same as the last 30, 40 in terms of how that governance structure works. And maybe at the end of the day, we all agree that it should stay the same and things are working pretty fine. But I have a feeling that if you brought some folks together to chat, there might be some new ideas and some different approaches that could be potentially applied.
Yeah, I think, again, a discussion. A lot of people don't know that Metro Vancouver even exists. They don't know that Sav Dhaliwal, the Burnaby City Councillor, has been around for a long time. Sav's a very nice guy, but he's been the chair there for a long time. And a lot of people just don't know that it exists and they don't realize what they're paying for. So I guess that, again, a little bit of a review of that so that the public can know how their dollars are being spent might be a worthwhile initiative. So I'm going to move into November, which was only, 5 or 6 weeks ago, but boy, oh boy, we really, it'll be a November that we'll always remember for a long time. The succession of bad weather that kept on happening through the fall that ultimately resulted in a huge triggered floods in several parts of Southwest British Columbia and on Vancouver Island as well, shutting down freeways, shutting off all the major transportation routes, including road and rail, into Southwest BC for many days. People were cut off by landslides. People were swept away. People died as a result of it. And a major artery through BC, the Coquihalla Highway, was broken in about 20 different spots, with bridges being washed out, unbelievable damage that resulted from this. What we did see was an interesting debate that emerged around the role of local government versus the senior levels of government in terms of disaster response. I remember Jason Lum, who I've never met, but I kept on hearing from him. He's the chair of the Fraser Valley Regional District, another regional district, said that he was being told to go ahead and spend money that he said his regional district had no signing authority to do that. So huge amounts of dollars, tens of millions of dollars that he was being told to go ahead and spend on that he said he simply couldn't. So the question is, if we look back on what happened with that disaster, was the role of local government, was local government the right place to make these kinds of decisions, or do we need to have a rethink about how that response works? These changes were made, I think, during Gordon Campbell's early time of his governments in the early 2000s, I understand. Is it time to rethink that, or do we just need to refine what we have right now?
Well, I do know that the emergency response legislation is being reformed. I believe a new iteration of it is coming into the House this spring. But what I will say is, these climate issues that we're dealing with and how they're manifesting themselves in forest fires and floods and heat domes, et cetera, they're not going away. So any scientist that you talk to that's, is actually a scientist and not just didn't get their PhD on Twitter or reading Facebook, they will tell you that this is going to become the new norm. So we're going to be seeing this happening over and over and over again. And so we better, look at the way we're reacting to this with the same importance as we are actually rebuilding the Coquihalla and doing all the other stuff. Those are, that's kind of a manifestation of the climate change and the climate catastrophes, but we have to pull back a little bit, like you said, and maybe look at kind of, do we have the right tools? Are our municipal governments in the right position to be dealing with a lot of this stuff? My view on it is that, you want the people who are closest to the ground to be the ones to be able to be initiating the response. You don't want someone from Ottawa sitting at the, in Gatineau, running an emergency response program in Vancouver. You just don't. We all know that's not going to work. But we know that the dollars and the ability to declare things like states of emergency, et cetera, rest with senior levels of government. So how is this going to work? And that's why I think that, what I'd be advocating for is that we get the First Nations, we get municipal governments, we get the federal and provincial governments to have a symposium, sit down, begin discussing this right now as to whether or not we're prepared. And I would dare say that the feedback that we're going to get is probably that we're not ready. But 2022, without, I don't have a crystal ball, but I have a feeling, Mike, that we're going to be talking about more floods and more disasters, et cetera. I will just say in closing that, we have come to realize, I know personally, myself, my family, and I'm sure yours as well, and everyone who's kind of listening or watching this has realized in a way we never could before how important supply chains are to our lives in terms of being able to get everything from bread and food and tomatoes and vegetables and right through to buying a fridge or even, purchasing any product from your home. This ecosystem, the supply chain that we have, is so intricate and so relies upon just-in-time delivery of ships and things and everything else that with everything we've gone through, can you only imagine if we had a much larger scale disaster throughout the whole Metro Vancouver? And I don't want to say what that is because it'll probably freak people out, but we all know that we are in a seismic zone. We are in an area that, something can happen seismically. And are we prepared? And I would look at what we've done in the last 6 months with the various issues that have happened. And I don't think we are. I think I don't think we're quite prepared as the folks tell us to have enough food and water and heating supplies, all the stuff that we need to survive. I don't think, I know a lot of people within my own circle aren't prepared for that. So that's where political leadership comes in. And that's where we've got to get our political leaders to sit down and help us as a community and as a province and as a country, get ourselves ready. And I'm hoping that someone like Mike Farnworth, who's, you know, been at kind of the leadership position here provincially, he might be able to initiate something like that and getting the municipal folks together. I'm hoping at things like UBCM that maybe they theme a whole UBCM around emergency response and getting prepared and maybe getting the federal and provincial government to come in. Those are the kind of things, Mike, I think need to happen very soon. And I'm confident if you get the right experts in the room and you get your political leadership and support there, we can come up with a good plan to better deal with this. But right now, I don't think we're ready.
Great ideas. And hopefully people are listening. But in 2022, we got to get started on that as soon as possible. So we're now into the month of December. And again, so many important stories, a lot that we had to kind of have put on the cutting room floor. But I want to talk about property tax increases. Now, typically budgets are produced in the month of December at the end of the year, and it's a chance for the public and for council to weigh in. And City of Vancouver seems to have days-long meetings about property taxes. They're not unique, but what has been a pattern lately is the increases that we used to be shocked at when they were even, you know, 2.5% or 3% or 4% tax increases, we're now seeing 6% and 7% and sometimes higher percent increases, not only in Vancouver, but in other cities. I don't think this pattern is going to change. It seems to me that municipalities are taking on significantly higher costs for everything from the cost of labor to initiatives that were not usually the traditional bailiwick of local government, i.e. housing, social supports for opioid crisis and what have you. Daniel, what's the future and what can be done about a future that looks like we're just going to be shelling out a lot more money? It's going to reach a breaking point for a lot of people who, as you pointed out earlier, are not getting that kind of additional increase to their own income to try and match it.
Well, Mike, I think, you know, from my perspective, I think nobody likes tax increases. I don't think anybody that I know, or I don't think you know, or anybody that's watching this likes tax increases. Nobody does. But yet, you know, there's no shortage of demand for more services. There's no shortage of demand for municipal governments to do everything from A to Z to tackling climate change and dealing with truth and reconciliation. There's lots of issues that are coming at our municipal elected officials, and a lot of that comes with a price tag. So you've got this kind of conundrum where cities have the least amount. I think they collect 7 cents on a dollar of every tax dollar that's collected. So they have the least amount of ability to collect, and property taxes is primarily where they get most of their funds from. And then there's this huge demand for more services and more of everything. I think that, you know, from a taxpayer perspective, if they feel they're getting value out of the additional services, so if they feel, or the cost, if they feel there's a value there commensurate with that 2% or 3% or 4% increase, I think you've seen, Mike, that, you know, you don't see people protesting at City Hall. You don't see people kind of, you know, there are people who are not going to be happy for sure. You know, there are folks that will just never like any increase, and that's understandable too. But I think where we're facing a bit of a challenge moving forward is we've been living, Mike, in an era of 2% inflation. And that means that basically people's grocery bills and their gas bills and everything else have been going up relatively about the same as their paychecks. That's out the window. We're now dealing with a federal government that, who would have thought, is spending what, $300-400 billion this year? You know, like, just only 4 years ago, that would have been preposterous to think about that. So they're pouring in lots of money into the economy. We've got issues of inflation, which are cropping up. You go to the grocery stores, you know, it's costing you way more to buy groceries today than it did even 6-12 months ago. So what will be interesting to watch, and I think this is what's going to be for the politicos out there to be careful about, is, you know, when you're increasing your property taxes at a higher level than, say, the rate of inflation, if inflation is 2%, you might be able to get away with that for a little while. But when inflation's like 5% and 6% or 7%, and people's paychecks are being eroded every single month, I think there's going to be a heightened interest in the amount of property taxes that people are paying. And when I look at the City of Vancouver, it is staggering. I think, what is it, 6 or 7% increase compared?
Yeah, 6.53% this year, about 18% in the last 3 years in property tax increases.
Right. And the vast majority of that is going actually not to new programs. It's not going to new services or anything. It's just going effectively to cover additional labor costs. So you're not really getting any extra services. So a lot of people are going to be asking themselves, I'm paying 7% more. Where is the 6 or 7% more services? Where are the pools, the community centers, the rinks, all the kind of things that people are asking for? And I think that they're going to come short when they get the response back from City Hall. So I don't know. I've long kind of believe that if people have value out of the tax dollars, there's going to be a sense that, yeah, it's costing me more, but things are running pretty well and I'm happy. But we're in all the rules have changed of the game with COVID. Everything is out the window right now, and who knows where we're going to be in the next 2 to 3 years in terms of things like inflation.
So that brings us to the end of the year. And again, so many important stories, many that we didn't sort of cover off. I know there were controversies over feet being run over and other kinds of stories that popped up all around the province. But I want to just really do something that we haven't done before. Maybe it'll be a new tradition for us. I want to give a special recognition to local government leaders. I'm going to call it the City Caucus list, the City Caucus 2021 list of local government leaders that we think deserve to be recognized. And I think the extraordinary time that we faced last month during the natural disasters, the flooding, we saw some people who really rose to the challenge. And I know that, again, there were so many people out on the ground that were doing important work. But I like to think that there were a few that just jumped out at us when we were kind of scanning the headlines. They were in the town of Princeton, in the town of Merritt, the community around the Nicola Valley and the Coldwater River, all which were devastated by flooding, and of course, the city of Abbotsford. So I'm going to list off the names of our honorable mention list. Spencer Coyne, who is the mayor of Princeton, seeing him out directing traffic on Highway 5A and being so passionate and available to media to answer questions about all the stress of having all that traffic having to go through his town. Mayor Linda Brown from the city of Merritt, BC, her entire town had to be evacuated within a few hours. 7,000 people were told to get out because their sewer system had shut down. It was an unbelievable story. I also wanted to recognize Chief Arnold Lampro from the Shakan First Nation, who was regularly talking about, first of all, the important role that First Nations play in terms of that response. But he was out there really getting ahead of and letting people know about the scale of the destruction and disaster, Highway 8, which was completely destroyed. But I'm going to leave our last name for our City Caucus Local Government Leader of 2021 to Mayor Henry Braun of the City of Abbotsford. Mayor Braun was recognized in many columns and others who just saw him on the screen every night. I must admit, it was very emotionally impactful to see him being up, getting 2 hours sleep, having to try and guide people who were trying to close off dikes that were broken and making sure that water pumps are working and being there for everybody. It really was an example to me of some of the best leadership that we can, that local government can bring. Any sort of quick thoughts on what you saw with some of those names and during that that very trying time?
Well, I agree with, obviously, with that list. And that, like you said, we could probably have named another 20 other municipal leaders. But absolutely, I think with our municipal leaders, it really is where the rubber meets the road. And these mayors, these particularly the mayors and the chiefs, are right there with their people. And that's why you see them very emotional on the 6 o'clock news, because they're neighbors, they're living and they're in those communities, and they're having to make extremely tough decisions in a very short period of time. And I applaud all of them and everyone who was involved at, you know, city halls. And I mean, you and I have heard stories, Mike, of, you know, folks who are working in city hall literally as things are burning around them, and they're just, you know, they're there at city hall. They're keeping the lights on, keeping the power going, making sure that there's still sewer, water, everything in those communities. And they're heroes. They're people who don't maybe get that recognition all the time, but we rely, and we just saw it in the last 6 months when we have disasters. We go to our mayors, we go to our local councils. That's where we need to go to get things running and to make sure people are safe in partnership with the federal and provincial government. That's where it happens. So great list. I fully concur, and kudos to Mayor Braun. You know, he's a hero to many people in that community. And I know he saved lives and he saved a lot of properties, and he deserves a lot of respect.
Yeah, so many people we could recognize, including MLAs and members of parliament, and again, all the unsung heroes working the desks inside of local governments, right through the Fraser Valley, through the Coquihalla. What an extraordinary year. But again, we have so much admiration for local government. And that's why you and I get together and get to talk about something, a subject that we love, which is local government in BC. Daniel, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. All the very best to you and your family for 2022. I know you are doing some incredibly important work with the Métis Nation of British Columbia right now. And so I salute you for those efforts, but also, again, wish you all the very best for the year to come.
I wish you all the best as well, and very much looking forward to 2022. I am hopeful that we will come out of next year better than we did this one, and that we'll be stronger and more resilient, and you know, our community will even be you know, stronger as a result of it. So thanks, Mike, for this, and I am appreciative of you taking the time and initiating this little podcast. It's a topic of mine that I really enjoy. I love talking about local municipal government. Don't get a chance to do it as much as I used to, so it really is nice to be able to have this opportunity to speak with you. So thanks for pulling this together.
Great thoughts. Thanks a lot, Daniel.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks again to my guest, Métis Nation British Columbia Deputy Minister and CEO and co-founder of citycaucus.com, Daniel Fontaine. It was great to discuss a topic that we're both so passionate about. To my listeners, I ask that you kindly like, share, and rate the podcast. Visit www.overcastyvr.ca to learn more about how you can support Vancouver Overcast with Mike Klassen. See you next time.